Coming up on Star Stuff, stellar beacons helping to define cosmic distance across the universe, an unexpected discovery about black hole physics, and what's speeding up the winds on Venus. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
The spectacular death of a star in a supernova explosion bright enough to be seen millions of light years away has given astronomers a rare opportunity to calibrate cosmic distance scales across the universe. The study, reported in the Astrophysical Journal and on the pre-press physics blog archive.org, increases the precision of distance measurements beyond the Milky Way and also helps improve science's understanding of these cataclysmic events. The explosion, which is known as a Type 1A or thermonuclear supernova, occurred last October, 60 million light-years away, in a galaxy called NGC 1365. The supernova, called SN 2012FR, sparked tremendous interest in the astronomical community because the same galaxy was already known to contain a type of star called a Cepheid variable. Both Type 1A supernovae and Cepheid variables are used by astronomers as cosmic distance markers, so-called standard candles. A Type 1A supernova occurs when a white dwarf star, the dead corpse of a star similar to our Sun, in a close binary system with another star, is constantly sucking mass off that companion star. Now, as it sucks more and more mass, the white dwarf gets bigger and bigger. Eventually, it reaches something called the Chandrasekhar limit, 1.4 times the mass of the Sun. At that point, the electron degeneracy, which is stopping the star collapsing any further, breaks down, and the star explodes cataclysmically in a thermonuclear or Type 1A supernova. Because this explosion always occurs when the white dwarf star reaches 1.4 solar masses, astronomers can use Type 1A supernovae as standard candles. They know exactly how bright the explosion is, and therefore, the fainter that explosion appears from their viewpoint on Earth, the further away it must have happened. It's a standard candle. In the case of Cepheid variable stars, there's a regular periodic change in the star's brightness. This regular rate of change is linked to the star's mass and luminosity, and that tells astronomers how bright the star really is. And so once again, the further away that star is, the fainter it's going to appear. Again, it's a standard candle. But these two distance markers operate on very different scales. Cepheid variables, for example, can be used for maybe 100 million light-years at most. But supernovae can be seen right across the universe, billions of light-years away. The rare occasions when both occur in the one galaxy allows astronomers to cross-calibrate, providing them with two independent distance measurements of the same galaxy. When supernova 2012FR exploded, it provided scientists with one of these great observing opportunities. So many people were looking at it that huge volumes of data came flooding in. Scientists, including Dr. Michael Childress from the Australian National University, were able to study the supernova explosion in minute detail. In fact, they observed it every night for the first 3 weeks after the initial explosion, watching in very fine detail how it evolved. As they watched, they detected unusual layering in the material being ejected during the explosion. In fact, they found two distinct layers of silicon, a thick outer layer, much larger than anything previously observed, which eventually faded away in about a week and a half, and a deeper, thin layer that hardly seemed to change at all. Childress says he's seen this double layering before, but never in such exquisite detail. In previous examples, the most people ever got to see was maybe a single observation of the supernova, and in that, they simply saw a snapshot of this double layering in time. They didn't have any information on exactly how thick it was or how long it would last. The difference was with this supernova, Childress and team had so much more information to examine.
Well, the very earliest data that we were taking on the supernova looked very much like a normal supernova. It had the same chemical signatures that we're used to seeing, silicon, calcium, all of those things. And then we noticed that the silicon feature suddenly developed two structures in it. So we were able to see very clearly that there were two distinct layers in the silicon. And as we watched that evolve over the course of a few weeks after the supernova exploded, we saw that the outer layer faded away after about a week and a half. And what we were able to map out the structure of that outer layer, we discovered that that outer layer was very, very large, much larger than had been ever observed in a previous supernova, because we have in the past seen this double layering, but we haven't ever seen it in such exquisite detail.
Do we know what caused that? Is it shell burning or...?
Well, there's several theories out there as to what could be causing it. So some people think that there may have been some surface burning on the surface of the white dwarf before the explosion, so you know, many thousands to millions of years before the explosion, that ejected some material that was enriched in this silicon and calcium and the related elements. And so some people have posited that perhaps what we're seeing is absorption by the silicon material that was ejected at an earlier time. Now, what's probably more popular in recent years is this surface burning that's happening at the time of the explosion. And in fact, there's some theories, there's one theory called the double detonation theory that says that surface burning might actually cause the supernova itself. So what happens is you have a surface layer of some helium that ignites and produces silicon, calcium, and those related elements. And then that explosion on the surface sends a shock through the white dwarf star, and that ignites the material in the core of the star and causes the entire thing to explode as a supernova. So that possibility is very exciting.
There have been other observations like this.
What's so great about this supernova is that it was discovered within a day of when it exploded, and we observed it every single night for the first 3 weeks after it exploded. So we were able to watch in really fine detail how that outer layer evolved. Whereas in previous examples, most people have only been able to have a single observation and to see this outer layer at one single snapshot in time. And so they had no information about how thick that layer is. They just knew that it was there at some point.
Does this mean we're looking at a different type of type 1A supernovae?
We're not sure. I think that the difference between this and previous supernovae is probably related to the fact that we just have so much more information on this one.
Right. Okay, and of course, the reason you were studying this, we're trying to get a better handle on the size of the universe around us, and type 1A supernovae are a great cosmic distance marker.
That's right, and that's what sparked so much of the interest in the supernova in the first place, because it occurred in a galaxy which had an independent distance measurement from these Cepheid variable star observations done by the Hubble Space Telescope. That was known the day that it was discovered. And so immediately, many, many telescopes were pointing at this supernova. Our colleagues who contacted their collaborators in South Africa pointed at the supernova within a matter of hours after we did. So we were the first ones to figure it out, to classify it, and then so many other people were observing it that we had such a huge volume of data. And it was really motivated by the fact that we knew it was going to be in a galaxy with this other distance indicator. And so it would let us calibrate that whole distance ladder much better.
That's Dr. Michael Childress from the Australian National University. The European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope Interferometer has gathered the most detailed observations ever of dust around a supermassive black hole at the centre of a galaxy. However, rather than finding all the glowing dust in the donut-shaped torus around the black hole as expected, astronomers have located a lot of it being blown up and below the torus. The observations show that the dust is being pushed away from the black hole as a sort of cool wind. It's a surprising finding, challenging current theories about how supermassive black holes evolve and interact with their surroundings. When astronomers talk about dust in space, they're actually referring to grains as fine as smoke, rather than something the size of dust bunnies you see under the couch. Over the last 20 years, scientists have found that most galaxies have supermassive black holes at their centre. We have one at the centre of the Milky Way, located about 26,000 light-years away from Earth. It's called Sagittarius A star, and it's about 3.7 million times the mass of the Sun. These supermassive central black holes are growing by drawing in matter from their surroundings. As they do so, this matter is torn apart at the subatomic level, releasing enormous amounts of energy, making these objects the most energetic in the universe. Astronomers have a name for a feeding supermassive black hole. They call it an AGN, or active galactic nuclei. The central regions of these brilliant gravity well powerhouses are ringed by these donut-shaped toruses of cosmic dust dragged from the surrounding space, in a process which looks similar to how water forms a small whirlpool around the plug hole of a sink. It was always thought that most of the strong infrared radiation coming from these active galactic nuclei originated in these donuts. But new observations of a nearby active galaxy called NGC 3783 have given scientists a bit of a surprise. Although the hot dust at some 700 to 1,000 degrees Celsius is indeed in the torus just as expected, they found huge amounts of cooler dust above and below this main torus. The newly discovered dust forms a cool wind streaming outwards from the black hole. This wind plays an important role in the complex relationship between the black hole and its surrounding environment. The black hole feeds its sensational appetite from the surrounding material, but the intense radiation this produces also seems to be blowing material away. It's still unclear exactly how these two processes work together, allowing supermassive black holes to grow and evolve within galaxies. But the presence of the dusty wind adds a new piece to this picture. In fact, the new observations may lead to a paradigm shift in our understanding of active galactic nuclei. Models of how the dust is distributed and how supermassive black holes grow and evolve now need to take this new discovery into consideration. Close-up images of a collapsing solar flare has opened a new window into the little-understood processes occurring during these violent eruptions. The study, reported in the journal Science, has for the first time allowed astronomers to link rare brightening events on the Sun's surface with the rain of material falling back down onto the Sun from an erupting solar flare. Researchers, including the study's lead author, Associate Professor Fabio Rial from the University of Palermo, made the observations while studying the eruption of a solar flare on the 7th of June 2011. Rial says it was the first time these brightening events have been seen and explained as a direct consequence of the impact of solar flare material raining down. The observations were part of an investigation by Rial and colleagues into the accretion of material onto the surfaces of newborn stars. Computer simulations of the event allowed the authors to see exactly what's happening as high-density million-degree plasma falls back down onto the Sun at speeds of 450 kilometers per second, generating powerful bow shocks as it rains down. Rial says the bow shocks are very faint and not detected in real observations. He and his team examined the eruption in visible, ultraviolet, extreme ultraviolet, and X-ray wavelengths using NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory spacecraft. They noted the X-ray emissions were far lower than expected. Rial explains that as being due to the absorption of the material along the line of sight. He says the thick chromosphere and the dense bouncing material stop a large part of the X-rays getting through. Professor Ivor Cairns from the University of Sydney says the solar flare material raining down onto the Sun's surface does provide a nice analogy with the accretion of material onto the star. But Cairns points out there are also some key differences.
It does sound as though the characteristic speeds are similar. The environments into which the material would be falling are quite different, I think. Our Sun being a fairly normal G-star and a T Tauri star being much hotter and younger and having a stronger wind of material blowing off the star. But I think it's more a way to try and study material falling from a circumstellar disk using data from our Sun. And here, I think it was unexpected by many people that there would be significant amounts of material that was, first of all, ejected during a solar flare or as part of a coronal mass ejection that then falls back onto the Sun. I think there are two aspects that are new. One is detailed investigation of darker cold material released in a flare that then collapses back down onto the surface and impacts it and causes brightenings in ultraviolet light and extreme ultraviolet light.
But not so much in X-rays, interestingly enough.
And not very much in X-rays, which, as you said, is interesting. But the other element, I think, here is the computer simulations, which show that a material moving back down should acquire relatively large speeds comparable to those observed, so, you know, around about a few hundred kilometers a second, and that you should get significant brightenings when that material impacts the solar surface and the dense plasma there.
The collapsing of the solar flare, the darker material, which is the cooler material, I take it, and the brightening that causes when it hits the chromosphere.
That's right. The raining down of some ejected material that didn't quite have enough energy to escape from the sun's gravity and then moves back down and causes brightenings as that material hits the photosphere.
Mm. And those brightenings, I take it, are an increase in temperature, 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 6 Kelvin.
10 to the 6 is 1 million degrees.
1 million degrees.
But it is exciting because those temperatures are standard coronal temperatures. A million degrees, maybe up to 10 million for the ions, for protons and helium ions in the corona. And understanding how the heating of the corona occurs is one of the major questions of space physics and, in fact, of astrophysics as well. So this work is interesting because it gives you heating to, you know, at least...
A million degrees Kelvin.
Degrees for some of the material that rains back down. And there have been real questions as to whether whether much of the corona is heated higher up or whether some of it's heated actually quite low down, 10,000 kilometers or so above the photosphere, and then moves back up. They don't actually describe how that heating really occurs. There's a little bit of reference to a bow shock preceding some of these materials, and I am certain that bow shock is causing significant heating. A bow shock develops any time you have an object moving faster than the speed of sound or of the oscillations in the magnetic field. So it's greater than the Alfvén speed or the sound speed.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what's happening here.
Alfvén waves, they're waves of magnetic pressure?
Yes, they are. Yeah. Another way of thinking of them is that if you have a magnetic field line, it's nice, like a string in your plasma, and you wiggle it transverse, you sort of flip your hand up and down, causing that string to oscillate along as it travels. And the Alfvén wave is doing exactly that for a magnetic field line. When most people talk about accretion of material from a disk around a star onto the stellar surface, they tend to talk about a nice uniform magnetic funnel. And what these authors are doing is looking at blobs of material that rain down by themselves. And so it calls into question the idea of a regular stream of material or down a magnetic field funnel, as they call it for the in astrophysics, because what they're observing for the sun is something that's much more bursty and intermittent.
Is it fair to make an analogy between what's happening on the sun with collapsing material from a solar flare and the circumstellar disk around a newborn star?
I think it's a clever way of approaching accretion from a disk around another star. I think that there are analogies here and that they're able to exploit them because we don't have nearly such good data for other stars and circumstellar disks. And I think it's an attractive analysis, and it seems as though they've discovered this material raining down after a flare, and it does cause brightenings when the material impacts the solar surface. And it does look as though there's a nice analogy with the circumstellar accretion, but it also points out some differences in that here we're seeing much more intermittent or blobby material associated with isolated fragments
trains
of mass, you might say, coming down, whereas the standard picture in astrophysics is of a continuous stream of material.
being slurped up. Mm.
So I think that's interesting. My feeling is that the shockwaves that should precede their fragments of material or their isolated blobs of mass as it comes back down could actually be rather interesting. And I think that those have probably caused most of the heating that they're observing.
Should future studies be looking more at those shockwaves?
I think so. Mm. I think it's an example of where we can identify unexpected phenomena like shockwaves associated with this material draining down back towards the photosphere from where it came from. And there could well be interesting radio emissions and other signatures of that which have been observed in, for instance, radio observations, but not understood or properly interpreted. So I think this study might well have quite a lot of exciting implications for other areas.
That's Professor Ivor Cairns from the University of Sydney. The European Space Agency's Venus Express spacecraft has discovered that Venus's winds have steadily been getting faster over the past 6 years. Venus is well known for its curious super-rotating atmosphere, which whips around the planet every 4 Earth days. Now, this is in stark contrast to the speed of the planet's rotation itself. In fact, the length of a day on Venus is 243 Earth days. And just to make things even more interesting, Venus rotates backwards. By tracking the movements of distinct features in the cloud tops some 70 kilometres above the planet's surface over a period of 10 Venusian years, that's about 6 Earth years, scientists have been able to monitor patterns in long-term global wind speeds. A report in the journal Icarus claims when Venus Express achieved orbital insertion in 2006, the average cloud top speeds between latitudes 50 degrees on either side of the equator were clocked at roughly 300 kilometres per hour. But the results of two separate studies have revealed that these already remarkably rapid winds are becoming even faster, increasing to 400 kilometres an hour over the course of the mission, a 25% increase. Such a large variation has never been observed on Venus before, and scientists don't really understand why it's occurred. The study, led by Dr. Igor Kantuntsev from the Space Research Institute in Moscow, determined the wind speeds by measuring how cloud features in images moved between frames. Over 45,000 features were painstakingly tracked by hand, and more than 350,000 further features were tracked automatically using a computer program. Meanwhile, a complementary study by a Japanese team used their own automatic cloud tracking methods to derive cloud motions. Their results would be published in the Journal of Geophysical Research. On top of this long-term increase in average wind speeds, both studies also revealed regular variations linked to the local time of day and the altitude of the sun above the horizon. One regular oscillation occurs roughly every 4.8 days near the equator and is thought to be connected to atmospheric waves at lower altitudes. But the researchers also unveiled some harder-to-explain curiosities. For example, cloud motions at low latitudes in the southern hemisphere show that over 6 years of the study, the velocity of the winds changed by up to 70 kilometres per hour over a timescale of 255 Earth days. Now that's just slightly longer than a year on Venus. Both research teams also saw dramatic variations in the average wind speed between consecutive orbits of Venus Express around the planet. In some cases, wind speeds at low latitudes varied so much that clouds could complete a journey around the planet in 3.9 days, while on other occasions, it took the clouds 5.3 days to cover the same distance. Scientists currently have no explanation for either of these variations or for the long-term overall increase in Venusian wind speeds. Looking around the websites, it's hard to miss all the hype about last Sunday's so-called supermoon. So, what are the facts? Well, firstly, the name was invented by an astrologer, so that's got to tell you something about the scientific validity of it all. Astrologers are not scientists. They're not astronomers. I only heard the term for the first time last year, at least in my little corner of the world. So, it was never really a big issue until then. So, what is the so-called supermoon? Well, just as the Earth's orbit around the Sun isn't perfectly circular but slightly elongated, the Moon's 29-day orbit around the Earth, is also slightly elliptical. The point in this orbit when the Moon is closest to the Earth is called perigee. And on the 23rd of June, the Moon was at perigee and was just 356,699 kilometres away from the Earth. Now, to put that in perspective, a couple of weeks earlier on June the 9th, when the Moon was at apogee, that is the most distant point from Earth in its orbit, Luna, that's the Moon's real name, by the way, Luna was 406,486 kilometres away, a difference of about 14% from perigee. Every 29 days or so, we also get a full Moon. That's when Luna is opposite the Sun in the sky, and we can see its face fully illuminated. We experienced a full Moon on June 23rd, the same day as the Moon was at perigee. When the full Moon happens at perigee, as it did on Sunday evening, that's what some people are now calling a supermoon. And despite what you may have heard, it does not spell doom, gloom, or destruction. At most, it means a slightly higher than normal tide. That's because the Moon's an itsy-bitsy bit closer to the Earth, and so its gravitational effect is a bit stronger, making high tide a few centimetres higher than normal. But still not as high as a high tide when perigee occurs at new moon. That's when the Moon and the Sun are on the same side of the Earth. The combined gravitational effect of both the Moon and the Sun create the highest of tides. Scientifically conducted tests have found no increase in emergency call-outs by police or any increased level of activity in hospital emergency rooms. So to put it simply, the whole supermoon thing is just a bunch of hype, and there's no real effect on the Earth. But its effect on the human imagination and its sheer beauty as a spectacle, well, that's something else. And that's the show for now. If you've missed part of it on the radio or you want to hear the show again, don't forget Star Stuff's available as a weekly podcast at abc.net.au/science/Star Stuff. The Star Stuff blog's always packed full of the latest news, spectacular images, stuff I find amusing, and heaps of other media we simply couldn't fit in the show. You can find it all at abcstarstuff.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase, and that's Tumblr without the E. And there's our ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest developments in astronomy, space sciences and cosmology as they happen. We give you current news, information, ongoing updates and cool URLs. Just Google in the at symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all as one word in lowercase, and we'll keep you informed. And for the latest news in science and technology, go to the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science.